A Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin. A Song of Ice and Fire began life as a trilogy and has since expanded to 6 books. As J. R. R. Tolkien once said, the tale grew in the telling. The setting for the books is the great continent of Westeros, in a world both like and unlike our own, where the seasons last for years and sometimes decades. Standing hard against the sunset sea at the western edge of the known world, Westeros stretches from the red sands of Dorne in the south to the icy mountains and frozen fields of the north, where snow falls even during the long summers. The Children of the Forest were the first known inhabitants of Westeros during the dawn of days, a race small of stature who made their homes in the greenwood and carved strange faces in the bone-white weirwood trees. Then came the first men, who crossed a land bridge from the larger continent to the east with their bronze swords and horses, and warred against the children for centuries before finally making peace with the older race and adopting their nameless ancient gods. The compact marked the beginning of the Age of Heroes, when the first men and the children shared Westeros, and 100 petty kingdoms rose and fell. Other invaders came in turn. The Andals crossed the narrow sea in ships, and with iron and fire they swept across the kingdoms of the first men and drove the children from their forests, putting many of the weirwoods to the axe. They brought their own faith, worshipping a god with 7 aspects, whose symbol was a 7-pointed star. Only in the far north did the first men, led by the Starks of Winterfell, throw back the newcomers. Elsewhere, the Andals triumphed and raised kingdoms of their own. The Children of the Forest dwindled and disappeared, while the first men intermarried with their conquerors. The Rowenar arrived some thousands of years after the Andals and came not as invaders but as refugees, crossing the seas in 10,000 ships to escape the growing might of the Freehold of Valyria. The lords of Freeholder of Valyria ruled the greater part of the known world. They were sorcerers, great in lore, and alone of all the races of man, they had learned to breed dragons and bend them to their will. 400 years before the opening of A Song of Ice and Fire, however, the doom descended on Valyria, destroying the city in a single night. Thereafter, the great Valyrian Empire disintegrated into dissension, barbarism, and war. Westeros, across the narrow sea, was spared the worst of the chaos that followed. By that time, only 7 kingdoms remained where once there had been hundreds, but they would not stand for much longer. A scion of lost Valyria named Aegon Targaryen landed at the mouth of the Black Water with a small army, his 2 sisters, who were also his wives, and 3 great dragons. Riding on dragonback, Aegon and his sisters won battle after battle and subdued 6 of the 7 Westeros kingdoms by fire, sword, and treaty. The conqueror collected the melted, twisted blades of his fallen foes and used them to make a monstrous, towering, barbed seat, the Iron Throne, from which he ruled henceforth as Aegon, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rohirrim and the First Men, and Lord of the 7 Kingdoms. The dynasty founded by Aegon and his sisters endured for most of 300 years. Another Targaryen king, Daeron II, later brought Dorne into the realm, uniting all of Westeros under a single ruler. He did so by marriage, not conquest, for the last of the dragons had died half a century before. The Hedge Knight, published in the first legends, takes place in the last days of Good King Daeron's reign, about 100 years before the opening of the first of the Ice and Fire novels, with the realm at peace and the Targaryen dynasty at its height. It tells the story of the first meeting between Dunk, a Hedge Knight squire, and Egg, a boy who is rather more than he seems, and of the great tourney at Ashford Meadow. The Sworn Sword, the tale that follows, picks up their story a year or so later.
The Hedge Knight, A Tale of the 7 Kingdoms. Read for you by Eric Davies. The spring rains had softened the ground, so Dunk had no trouble digging the grave. He chose a spot on the western slope of a low hill, for the old man had always loved to watch the sunset. "Another day done," he would sigh.
And who knows what the morrow will bring us, eh, Dunk?
Well, one morrow had brought rains that soaked them to the bones, and the one after had brought wet, gusty winds, and the next a chill. By the fourth day, the old man was too weak to ride, and now he was gone. Only a few days past, he had been singing as they rode, the old song about going to Gulltown to see a fair maid. But instead of Gulltown, he'd sung of Ashford.
Off to Ashford to see the fair maid, hi-ho, hi-ho,
Dunk thought miserably as he dug. When the hole was deep enough, he lifted the old man's body in his arms and carried him there. He had been a small man and slim. Stripped of hauberk, helm, and sword belt, he seemed to weigh no more than a bag of leaves. Dunk was hugely tall for his age, a shambling, shaggy, big-boned boy of 16 or 17 years, no one was quite certain which, who stood closer to 7 feet than to 6, and had only just begun to fill out his frame. The old man had often praised his strength. He had always been generous in his praise. It was all he had to give. He laid him out in the bottom of the grave and stood over him for a time. The smell of rain was in the air again, and he knew he ought to fill the hole before the rain broke. But it was hard to throw dirt down on that tired old face.
There ought to be a septon here to say some prayers over him, but he only has me.
The old man had taught Dunk all he knew of swords and shields and lances, but had never been much good at teaching him words.
I'd leave your sword, but it would rust in the ground,
he said at last, apologetic.
The gods will give you a new one, I guess. I wish you didn't die, sir.
He paused, uncertain what else needed to be said. He didn't know any prayers, not all the way through. The old man had never been much for praying.
You were a true knight, and you never beat me when I didn't deserve it,
he finally managed.
Except that one time in Maidenpool. It was the inn-boy who ate the widow woman's pie, not me, I told you. It don't matter now. The gods keep you, sir.
He kicked dirt in the hole, then began to fill it methodically, never looking at the thing at the bottom.
He had a long life,
Dunk thought.
He must have been closer to 60 than to 50, and how many men can say that?
At least he had lived to see another spring. The sun was westering as he fed the horses. There were three, his sway-backed Stot, the old man's palfrey, and Thunder, his warhorse, who was ridden only in tourney and battle. The big brown stallion was not as swift or strong as he had once been, but he still had his bright eye and fierce spirit, and he was more valuable than everything else Dunk owned.
If I sold Thunder an old chestnut and the saddles and bridles too, I'd come away with enough silver to...
Dunk frowned. The only life he knew was the life of a hedge knight, riding from keep to keep, taking service with this lord and that lord, fighting in their battles and eating in their halls until the war was done, then moving on. There were tourneys from time to time as well, though less often, and he knew that some hedge knights turned robber during lean winters, though the old man never had.
I could find another hedge knight in need of a squire to tend his animals and clean his mail,
he thought.
Or might be I could go to some city, to Lannisport or King's Landing, and join the city watch, or else...
He had piled the old man's things under an oak. The cloth purse contained 3 silver stags, 19 copper pennies, and a chipped garnet. As with most hedge knights, the greatest part of his worldly wealth had been tied up in his horses and weapons. Dunk now owned a chainmail hauberk that he had scoured the rust off 1,000 times. An iron half-helm with a broad nasal and a dent on the left temple. A sword belt of cracked brown leather, and a long sword in a wooden leather scabbard. A dagger, a razor, a whetstone. Greaves and gorget, an 8-foot war lance of turned ash topped by a cruel iron point, and an oaken shield with a scarred metal rim bearing the sigil of Sir Arlan of Pennytree, a winged chalice, silver on brown. Dunk looked at the shield, scooped up the sword belt, and looked at the shield again. The belt was made for the old man's skinny hips. It would never do for him, no more than the hauberk would. He tied the scabbard to a length of hempen rope, knotted it around his waist, and drew the longsword. The blade was straight and heavy, good castle-forged steel, the grip soft leather wrapped over wood, the pommel a smooth, polished black stone. Plain as it was, the sword felt good in his hand, and Dunk knew how sharp it was, having worked it with whetstone and oilcloth many a night before they went to sleep.
"It fits my grip as well as it ever fit his," he thought to himself. "And there is a tourney at Ashford Meadow."
Sweetfoot had an easier gait than old Chestnut, but Dunk was still sore and tired when he spied the inn ahead, a tall daub and timber building beside a stream. The warm yellow light spilling from its windows looked so inviting that he could not pass it by.
"I have 3 silvers, he told himself, "enough for a good meal and as much ale as I care to drink."
As he dismounted, a naked boy emerged dripping from the stream as he began to dry himself on a rough-spun brown cloak.
"Are you the stable boy?"
Dunk asked him. The lad looked to be no more than 8 or 9, a pasty-faced, skinny thing, his bare feet caked in mud up to the ankle. His hair was the queerest thing about him. He had none.
"I'll want my palfrey rubbed down, and oats for all 3. Can you tend to them?"
The boy looked at him brazenly.
"I could, if I wanted."
Dunk frowned.
"I'll have none of that. I'm a knight, I'll have you know." "You don't look to be a knight."
"Do all knights look the same?"
"No, but they don't look like you either. Your sword belt's made of rope."
"So long as it holds my scabbard, it serves. Now, see to my horses. You'll get a copper if you do well, and a clout in the ear if you don't."
He did not wait to see how the stable boy took that, but turned away and shouldered through the door. At this hour, he would have expected the inn to be crowded, but the common room was almost empty. A young lordling in a fine damask mantle was passed out at one table, snoring softly into a pool of spilled wine. Otherwise, there was no one. Dunk looked around uncertainly until a stout, short, whey-faced woman emerged from the kitchens and said,
"Sit where you like. Is it ale you want or food?"
"Both."
Dunk took a chair by the window, well away from the sleeping man.
"There's good lamb roasted with crust of herbs and some ducks my son shot down. Which will you have?"
He had not eaten at an inn in 30 years or more.
"Both."
The woman laughed.
"Well, you're big enough for it."
She drew a tankard of ale and brought it to his table.
"Will you be wanting a room for the night as well?"
"No."
Dunk would have liked nothing better than a soft straw mattress and a roof above his head, but he needed to be careful with his coin. The ground would serve.
"Some food, some ale, and it's on to Ashford for me. How much farther is it?"
"A day's ride, bare north when the road forks at the burned mill. Is my boy seeing to your horses, or has he run off again?"
No, he's there," said Dunk. "You seem to have no custom."
"Half the town's gone to see the tourney. My own would as well, if I allowed it. They'll have this in when I go, but the boy would sooner swagger about with soldiers, and the girl turns to sighs and giggles every time a knight rides by. I swear I couldn't tell you why. Knights are built the same as other men, and I never knew a joust to change the price of eggs."
She eyed Dunk curiously. His sword and shield told her one thing, his rope belt and rough-spun tunic quite another.
"You're bound for the tourney yourself?"
He took a sip of the ale before he answered. A nut-brown color it was, and thick on the tongue, the way he liked it.
"Aye,"
he said.
"I mean to be a champion."
"Do you now?"
the innkeep answered, polite enough. Across the room, the lordling raised his head from the wine puddle. His face had a sallow, unhealthy cast to it beneath a rat's nest of sandy brown hair, and blonde stubble crusted his chin. He rubbed his mouth, blinked at Dunk, and said,
"I dreamed of you."
His hand trembled as he pointed a finger.
"You stay away from me, you hear? You stay well away."
Dunk stared at him uncertainly.
My lord?
The innkeep leaned close.
"Never you mind that one, sir. All he does is drink and talk about his dreams.
I'll see about that food, she bustled off.
Food?
The lordling made the word an obscenity. He staggered to his feet, one hand on the table to keep himself from falling.
I'm going to be sick,
he announced. The front of his tunic was crusty red with old wine stains.
I wanted a whore, but there's none to be found here. All gone to Ashford Meadow. Gods be good, I need some wine.
He lurched unsteadily from the common room, and Dunk heard him climbing steps, singing under his breath.
A sad creature, Dunk thought. But why did he think he knew me?
He pondered that a moment over his ale. The lamb was as good as any he had ever eaten, and the duck was even better, cooked with cherries and lemons, and not near as greasy as most. The innkeep brought buttered peas as well, and oaten bread still hot from her oven.
This is what it means to be a knight,
he told himself as he sucked the last bit of meat off the bone.
Good food and ale whenever I want it, and no one to clout me in the head.
He had a second tankard of ale with the meal, a third to wash it down, and a fourth because there was no one to tell him he couldn't. And when he was done, he paid the woman with a silver stag and still got back a fistful of coppers. It was full dark by the time Dunk emerged. His stomach was full and his purse a little lighter, but he felt good as he walked to the stables. Ahead, he heard a horse whicker.
Easy, lad,
the boy's voice said. Dunk quickened his step, frowning. He found the stable boy mounted on Thunder and wearing the old man's armor. The hauberk was longer than he was, and he'd had to tilt the helm back on his bald head or else it would have covered his eyes. He looked utterly intent and utterly absurd. Dunk stopped in the stable door and laughed. The boy looked up, flushed, vaulted to the ground.
My lord, I did not mean...
Thief,
Dunk said, trying to sound stern.
Take off that armor, and be glad that Thunder didn't kick you in that fool head. He's a warhorse, not a boy's pony.
The boy took off the helm and flung it to the straw.
I could ride him well as you,
he said, bold as you please.
Close your mouth. I want none of your insolence. The hauberk, too. Take it off. What do you think you were doing? How can I tell you with my mouth closed?
The boy squirmed out of the chainmail and let it fall.
You can open your mouth to answer, said Dunk. Now pick up that mail, shake off the dirt, and put it back where you found it. And the half-helm, too. Did you feed the horses as I told you, and rub down Sweetfoot?
Yes,
the boy said, as he shook straw from the mail.
You're going to Ashford, aren't you? Take me with you, sir.
The innkeep had warned him of this.
And what might your mother say to that?
My mother?
The boy wrinkled up his face.
My mother's dead. She wouldn't say anything.
He was surprised. Wasn't the innkeep his mother? Perhaps he was only prenticed to her. Dunk's head was a little fuzzy from the ale.
Are you an orphan boy?
He asked, uncertainly.
Are you?
The boy threw back.
I was once, Dunk admitted, till the old man took me in.
If you took me, I could squire for you.
I have no need of a squire, he said.
Every knight needs a squire,
the boy said.
You look as though you need one more than most.
Dunk raised a hand threateningly.
And you look as though you need a clout in the ear, it seems to me. Fill me a sack of oats. I'm off for Ashford. Alone.
If the boy was frightened, he hid it well. For a moment, he stood there defiant, his arms crossed, but just as Dunk was about to give up on him, the lad turned and went for the oats. Dunk was relieved.
A pity I couldn't, but he has a good life here at the inn, a better one than he'd have squiring for a hedge knight. Taking him would be no kindness.
He could still feel the lad's disappointment, though, and he mounted Sweetfoot and took up Thunder's lead. Dunk decided that a copper penny might cheer him.
Here, lad, for your help.
He flipped the coin down at him with a smile, but the stable boy made no attempt to catch it. It fell in the dirt between his bare feet, and there he let it lie.
He'll scoop it up as soon as I'm gone, Dunk told himself.
He turned the palfrey and rode from the inn, leading the other two horses. The trees were bright with moonlight, and the sky was cloudless and speckled with stars. Yet as he headed down the road, he could feel the stable boy watching his back, sullen and silent.
Books on Tape presents A Storm of Swords, Book 3 of A Song of Ice and Fire, by George R. R. Martin, read by Roy Dotrice. Prologue. The day was grey and bitter cold, and the dogs would not take the scent. The big black bitch had taken one sniff at the bear tracks, backed off, and skulked back to the pack with her tail between her legs. The dogs huddled together miserably on the riverbank as the wind snapped at them. Chet felt it too, biting through his layers of black wool and boiled leather. It was too bloody cold for man or beast, but here they were. His mouth twisted, and he could almost feel the boils that covered his cheeks and neck growing red and angry.
"I should be safe back at the wall, tending the bloody ravens and making fires for old Maester Aemon."
It was the bastard John Snow who had taken that from him, him and his fat friend Sam Tarley. It was their fault he was here, freezing his bloody balls off with a pack of hounds deep in the haunted forest.
"Seven elves."
He gave the leashes a hard yank to get the dog's attention.
"Track, you bastards. That's a bear print. You want some meat or no? Find."
But the hounds only huddled closer, whining. Chet snapped his short lash above their heads, and the black bitch snarled at him.
"Dog meat would taste as good as bear,"
he warned her, his breath frosting with every word. Lark, the sister man, stood with his arms crossed over his chest and his hands tucked up into his armpits. He wore black wool gloves, but he was always complaining how his fingers were frozen.
"It's too bloody cold, Daunt," he said. "Bugger this bear, he's not worth freezing over."
"We can't go back empty hand, Lark," rumbled Smallpaw through the brown whiskers that covered most of his face. "The Lord Commander wouldn't like that."
There was ice under the big man's squash pug nose where his snot had frozen. A huge hand in a thick fur glove clenched tight around the shaft of a spear.
"Bugger that old bear too,"
said the sister man, a thin man with sharp features and nervous eyes.
"Mormont will be dead before daybreak, remember? Who cares what he likes?"
Smallpaw blinked his black little eyes. Maybe he had forgotten, Chet thought. He was stupid enough to forget almost anything.
"Why do we have to kill the old bear? Why don't we just go off and let him be?" "You think he'd let us be?" said Lark. "He'll hunt us down. You want to be hunted, you great muttonhead?"
"No," said Smallpaw. "I don't want that. I don't."
"So you'll kill him?" said Lark.
"Yes."
The huge man stamped the butt of his spear on the frozen riverbank.
"I will. He shouldn't hunt us."
The sister man took his hands from his armpits and turned to Chet.
"We need to kill all the officers, I say."
Chet was sick of hearing it.
"We've been over this. The old bear dies, and Blaine from the Shadow Tower. Grubbs and Aethon as well. They're ill luck for drawing the watch. Dywin and Bannon for their tracking, and Sir Piggy for the ravens. That's all. We kill 'em quiet while they sleep. One scream and we're worm food, every one of us."
His boils were red with rage.
"Just do your bit, and see that your cousins do theirs. And Paul, try and remember it's third watch, not second."
"Third watch,"
the big man said through hair and frozen snot.
"Me and Softfoot. I remember, Chet."
The moon would be black tonight, and they had jiggered the watches so as to have eight of their own standing sentry, with two more guarding the horses. It wasn't going to get much riper than that. Besides, the wildlings could be upon them any day now. Chet meant to be well away from here before that happened. He meant to live. 300 sworn brothers of the Night's Watch had ridden north, 200 from Castle Black, and another 100 from the Shadow Tower. It was the biggest ranging in living memory. near to a third of the Watcher's strength. They meant to find Ben Stark, Sir Waymar Royce, and the other rangers who'd gone missing, and discover why the wildlings were leaving their villages. Well, they were no closer to Stark and Royce than when they'd left the wall, but they'd learn where all the wildlings had gone, up into the icy heights of the godforsaken Frostfangs. They could squat up there till the end of time, and it wouldn't prick Chet's boils none. But no, they were coming down, down the Milkwater. Chet raised his eyes, and there it was. The river's stony banks were bearded by ice, its pale milky waters flowing endlessly down out of the Frostfangs. And now Mance Rayder and his wildlings were flowing down the same way. Thorin Smallwood had returned in a ladder 3 days past. While he was telling the old bear what his scouts had seen, his man, Kedge Whiteye, told the rest of them.
"They're still well up the foothills, but they're coming," Ked said, warming his hands over the fire. "Hama, the dog's head, has a van, the poxy bitch. Goldie crept up on her camp and saw her playing by the fire. That fool, Dumblejohn, wanted to pick her off with an arrow, but Smallwood had better sense." Chet spat. "How many were there, could you tell?" "Oh, many and more. 20,000, 30,000. We didn't stay to count. Armour had 500 in the van, everyone a horse."
The men around the fire exchanged uneasy looks. It was a rare thing to find even a dozen mounted wildlings. And 500?
"Smallwood sent Bannon and me wide round the van to catch a peek at the main body," Kedge went on. "There was no end of them. They're moving slow as a frozen river, 4-5 miles a day, but they don't look like they mean to go back to their villages, neither. More than half were women and children, and they were driving their animals before them, goats, sheep, even oryxes dragging sledges. They'd loaded up with bales of fur and sides of meat, cages of chickens, butcher churns and spinning wheels, every damn thing they own. The mules and garrons were so heavy laden, you'd think their backs would break. The women as well."
"And they follow the Milkwater?"
Lark, the sister man, asked.
"I said so, didn't I?"
The Milkwater would take them past the Fist of the First Men, the ancient ring fort where the Night's Watch had made its camp. Any man with a thimble of sense could see that it was time to pull up stakes and fall back on the wall. The old bear had strengthened the fist with spikes and pits and caltrops, but against such a host all that was pointless. If they stayed here, they would be engulfed and overwhelmed. And Thorin Smallwood wanted to attack. Sweet Donald Hill was squire to Sir Malador Locke, and the night before last Smallwood had come to Locke's tent. Sir Malador had been of the same mind as old Sir Otten Withers, urging a retreat on the wall. But Smallwood wanted to convince him otherwise.
"This king beyond the wall will never look for so far north," Sweet Donald reported him saying, "and this great host of his is a shambling horde, full of useless mouths who won't know what end of a sword to hold. One blow will take all the fight out of them and send them howling back to their hovels for another 50 years.
300 against 30,000. Chet called that rank madness. And what was madder still was that Sir Malador had been persuaded, and the two of them together were on the point of persuading the old bear.
"If we wait too long, this chance may be lost, never to come again,"
Smallwood was saying to anyone who would listen. Against that, Sir Otten Withers said,
"We are the shield that guards the realms of men. You do not throw away your shield for no good purpose."
But to that Thorin Smallwood said,
"In a sword for fair fight, a man's surest defence is a swift stroke that slays his foe, not cringing behind a shield."
Neither Smallwood nor Withers had the command, though. Lord Mormont did, and Mormont was waiting for his other scouts, for Jarman Buckwell and the men who'd climbed the giant stair, and for Corin Halfhand and Jon Snow, who'd gone to probe the Skirling Pass. Buckwell and the half-hand were late in returning, though.
Dead, most like.
Chet pictured Jon Snow lying blue and frozen on some bleak mountaintop with a wildling spear up his bastard arse. The thought made him smile.
I hope they killed his bloody wolf as well.
There's no bear here, he decided abruptly. Just an old print, that's all. Back to the fist.
The dogs almost yanked him off his feet, as eager to get back as he was. Maybe they thought they were going to get fed. Chet had to laugh. He hadn't fed them for 3 days now to turn them mean and hungry. Tonight, before slipping off into the dark, he'd turn them loose among the horse lines after Sweet Donald Hill and Clubfoot Carl cut the tethers.
They'll have snarling hounds and panicked horses all over the fist, running through fires, jumping a ring wall, and trampling down tents.
With all the confusion, it might be hours before anyone noticed that 14 brothers were missing. Lark had wanted to bring in twice that number, but what could you expect from some stupid fish-breath sister man? Whisper a word in the wrong ear, and before you knew it, you'd be short ahead. No, 14 was a good number, enough to do what needed doing, but not so many that they couldn't keep the secret. Chet had recruited most of them himself. Small Paul was one of his, the strongest man on the wall, even if he was slower than a dead snail. He'd once broken a wildling's back with a hug. They had Dirk as well, named for his favourite weapon, and the little grey man the brothers called Softfoot, who'd raped 100 women in his youth, and liked to boast how none had never seen nor heard him until he shoved it up inside them. The plan was Chet's. He was the clever one. He'd been steward to old Maester Aemon for 4 good years before that bastard Jon Snow had done him out, so his job could be handed to that fat pig of a friend. When he killed Sam Tarly tonight, he planned to whisper,
"Give my love to Lord Snow,"
right in his ear before he sliced the piggy's throat open to let the blood come bubbling out through all those layers of suet. Chet knew the ravens, so he wouldn't have no trouble there. No more than he would with Tarly. One touch of the knife, and that craven would piss his pants and start blubbering for his life.
Let him beg. It won't do him no good.
After he'd opened his throat, he'd open the cages and shoo the birds away, so no messages reached the wall. Softfoot and Small Paul would kill the old bear, Dirk would do Blaine, and Lark and his cousins would silence Bannon and old Dywin to keep them from sniffing after their trail. They'd been caching food for a fortnight, and Sweet Donald and Clubfoot Carl would have the horses ready. With Mormont dead, command would pass to Sir Utten Withers, an old Don man, and failing.
He'd be running for the wall before sundown, and he won't waste no men sending them after us neither.
The dogs pulled at him as they made their way through the trees. Chet could see the fist punching its way up through the green. The day was so dark that the old bear had the torches lit, a great circle of them burning all along the ring wall that crowned the top of the steep stony hill. The three of them waded across a brook. The water was icy cold, and patches of ice were spreading across its surface.
"I'm going to make for the coast," Lark the sister man confided. "Me and my cousins will build us a boat, sail back home to the sisters."
"And at home they'll know you for deserters and lop off your fool heads," thought Chet.
There was no leaving the night's watch, once you said your words. Anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms, they'd take you and kill you. Ollo Lophan now. He was talking about sailing back to Tyrosh, where he claimed men didn't lose their heads for a bit of honest thievery, nor get sent off to freeze their life away for being found in bed with some knight's wife. Chet had Wade going with him, but he didn't speak their wet, girly tongue. And what could he do in Tyrosh? He had no trade to speak of, growing up in Hagsmire. His father had spent his life grubbing in other men's fields and collecting leeches. He'd strip down bare but for a thick leather clout and go wading in the murky waters. When he climbed out, he'd be covered from nipple to ankle, Sometimes he made Chet help pull the leeches off. One had attached itself to his palm once, and he'd smashed it against a wall in revulsion. His father beat him bloody for that. The maesters bought the leeches at 12 for a penny. Lark could go home if he liked, and that damned Tyrushi too, but not Chet. If he never saw Hagsmire again, it would be too bloody soon. He had liked the look of Craster's keep himself. Craster lived high as a lord there, so why shouldn't he do the same? That would be a laugh. Chet, the leechman's son, a lord with a keep. His banner could be a dozen leeches on a field of pink. But why stop at lord? Maybe he should be a king.
Mance Raider started out as a crow. I could be a king, same as him, and have me some wives.
Craster had 19, not even counting the young ones, the daughters he hadn't gotten around to bedding yet. Half them wives were as old and ugly as Craster, but that didn't matter. The old ones Chet could put to work, cooking and cleaning for him, pulling carrots and slopping pigs, while the young ones warmed his bed and bore his children. Craster wouldn't object. Not once small Paul gave him a hug. The only women Chet had ever known were the whores he'd bought in Molestown. When he'd been younger, the village girls took one look at his face with its boils and its wen and turned away sickened. The worst was that slattern Bessa. She'd spread her legs for every boy in Hagsmire, so he figured, why not him too? He even spent a morning picking wildflowers when he heard she liked them, but she'd just laughed in his face and told him she'd crawl in a bed with his father's leeches before she'd crawl in one with him. She stopped laughing when he put his knife in her. That was sweet, the look on her face. So he pulled the knife out and put it in her again. When they caught him, down near Seven Streams, old Lord Walder Frey hadn't even bothered to come himself to do the judging. He'd sent one of his bastards, that Walder Rivers, and the next thing Chet had known, he was walking to the war with that foul-smelling black devil Yoren. To pay for his one sweet moment, they took his whole life. But now he meant to take it back. And Craster's women, too.
That twisted old wildling has the right of it. If you want a woman to wife, you take her. And none of this giving her flowers, so that maybe she don't notice your bloody boils.
Chet didn't mean to make that mistake again. It would work, he promised himself for the 100th time.
So long as we get away clean.
Sir Otten would strike south for the Shadow Tower, the shortest way to the wall.
He won't bother with us, not with us. All he'll want is to get back whole.
Thorin Smallwood now. He'd want to press on with the attack. But Sir Otten's caution ran too deep, and he was senior.
It won't matter anyhow. Once we're gone, Smallwood can attack anyone he likes. What do we care? If none of them ever returns to the wall, no one will ever come looking for us. They'll think we died with the rest.
That was a new thought, and for a moment it tempted him. But they would need to kill Sir Otten and Sir Malador Locke as well to give Smallwood the command, and both of them were well attended day and night. No, the risk was too great. "Chat," said Small Paul, as they trudged along a stony game trail through sentinels and soldier pines. "What about the bird?"
"What bloody bird?"
The last thing he needed now was some muttonhead going on about a bird.
"The old bear's raven," Small Paul said. "If we kill him, who's going to feed his bird?"
"Who bloody well cares? Kill a bird too, if you like."
"I don't want to kill no bird," the big man said. "But that's a talking bird. What if it tells what we did?"
Lark, the sister man, laughed.
"Small Paul, thick as a castle wall," he mocked.
"You shut up with that," said Small Paul dangerously.
"Paul," said Chet, before the big man got too angry, "when they find the old man lying in a pool of blood with his throat slit, they won't need no bird to tell them someone killed him."
Small Paul chewed on that a moment.
"That's true," he allowed. Can I keep the bird, then? I like that bird.
He's yours, said Chet, just to shut him up.
We can always eat him if we get hungry, offered Lark.
Smallpaw clouded up again.
Best not try and eat my bird, Lark. Best not.
Chet could hear voices drifting through the trees.
Close your bloody mouths, both of you. We're almost to the fist.
They emerged near the west face of the hill and walked around south, where the slope was gentler. Near the edge of the forest, a dozen men were taking archery practice. They had carved outlines on the trunks of trees and were loosing shafts at them.
Look, said Lark, a pig with a bow.
Sure enough, the nearest bowman was Sir Piggy himself, the fat boy who had stolen his place with Maester Aemon. Just the sight of Samwell Tarley filled him with anger. Stewarding for Maester Aemon had been as good a life as he'd ever known. The old blind man was undemanding, and Clydus had taken care of most of his wants anyway. Chet's duties were easy. Cleaning the rookery, a few fires to build, a few meals to fetch. And Aemon never once hit him.
Thinks he can just walk in and shove me out on account of being high-born and knowing how to read. Might be I'll ask him to read my knife before I open his soap with it.
You go on, he told the others. I want to watch this. The dogs were pulling anxious to go with them, to the food they thought would be waiting at the top. Chet kicked the bitch with the toe of his boot, and that settled him down some. He watched from the trees as the fat boy wrestled with a longbow as tall as he was, his red moon face screwed up with concentration. Three arrows stood in the ground before him. Tarley knocked and drew, held the draw a long moment as he tried to aim and let fly. The shaft vanished into the greenery. Chet laughed loudly, a snort of sweet disgust.
"Core will never find that one, and I'll be blamed," announced Ed Tollett, the dour, grey-headed squire everyone called Dolorous Ed. "Core, nothing ever goes missing that they don't look at me. Ever since that time I lost my horse, eh? As if that could be helped. He was white, and it was snowing, eh? What did they expect?"
"The wind took that one," said Gren, another friend of Lord Snow's.
"Try to hold the bow steady, Sam."
"That's heavy," the fat boy complained, but he pulled the second arrow all the same. This one went high, sailing through the branches 10 feet above the target.
I believe you knocked a leaf off that tree," said Dolorous Ed. "Fall is falling fast enough, eh? There's no need to help it." He sighed. "And we all know what follows fall, eh? God, but I'm cold. Cor, shoot the last arrow, Samwell. I believe my tongue is freezing to the roof of my mouth, eh?"
Sir Piggy lowered the bow, and Chet thought he was going to start bawling.
"That's too hard." "Notch, draw, and loose," said Gren. "Go on."
Dutifully, the fat boy plucked his final arrow from the earth, notched it to his longbow, drew, and released. He did it quickly, without squinting along the shaft, painstakingly, as he had the first two times. The arrow struck the charcoal outline low in the chest and hung quivering.
"I hit him!" Sir Piggy sounded shocked. "Gran, did you see? Ed, look, I hit him!"
"Put it between his ribs, I'd say," said Gren.
"Did I kill him?" the fat boy wanted to know.
Tullet shrugged.
"Might have punctured a lung if he had a lung. Most trees don't, as a rule, eh?"
He took the bow from Sam's hand.
"I've seen worse shots, though. Aye, and made a few."
Sir Piggy was beaming. To look at him, you'd think he'd actually done something. But when he saw Chet and the dogs, his smile curled up and died squeaking.
"You hit a tree," Chet said. "Let's see how you shoot when it's Manse Raiders' lads. They won't stand there with their arms out and their leaves rustling. Oh, no, they'll come right at you, screaming in your face, and I bet you'll piss those britches.
One of them will plant his axe right between those little pig eyes. The last thing you'll hear will be the thunk it makes when it bites into your skull."
The fat boy was shaking. Dolorous Ed put a hand on his shoulder. "Brother," he said solemnly, "just because it happened that way for you doesn't mean Samwell will suffer the same, eh?"
"What are you talking about, Tullet?"
"Call that axe that split your skull, eh? Is it true that half your wits leaked out on the ground and your dogs ate them, eh?" The big lout grin laughed, and even Samwell Tarley managed a weak little smile. Chet kicked the nearest dog, yanked on their leashes, and started up the hill.
"Smile all you want, Sir Piggy. We'll see who laughs tonight."
He only wished he had time to kill Tullet as well.
"Gloomy, horse-faced fool. That's what he is."
The climb was steep, even on this side of the fist, which had the gentler slope. Partway up, the dog started barking and pulling at him, figuring that they'd get fed soon. He gave them a taste of his boot instead, and a crack of the whip for the big ugly one that snapped at him. Once they were tied up, he went to report.
"The prints were there, like Giant said, but the dogs wouldn't track," he told Mormont in front of his big black tent. "Down by the river like that. Could be old prints."
"Yeah, pity." Lord Commander Mormont had a bald head and a great shaggy grey beard and sounded as tired as he looked. "We might all have been better for a bit of fresh meat." The raven on his shoulder bobbed its head and echoed,
"Meat, meat, meat."
"We could cook the bloody dogs," Chet thought, but he kept his mouth shut until the old bear sent him on his way. "And that's the last time I'll need to bow my head to that one," he thought to himself with satisfaction.
It seemed to him that it was growing even colder, which he would have sworn wasn't possible. The dogs huddled together miserably in the hard, frozen mud, and Chet was half tempted to crawl in with them. Instead, he wrapped a black wool scarf around the lower part of his face, leaving a slit for his mouth between the whines. It was warmer if he kept moving, he found, so he made a slow circuit of the perimeter with a wad of sour leaf, sharing a chew or two with the black brothers on guard and hearing what they had to say. None of the men on the day watch were part of his scheme. Even so, he figured it was good to have some sense of what they were thinking. Mostly what they were thinking was that it was bloody cold. The wind was rising as the shadows lengthened. It made a high, thin sound as it shivered through the stones of the ringwall.
"I hate that sound," Little Giant said. "It sounds like a babe in the brush, wailing away for milk."
When he finished the circuit and returned to the dogs, he found Lark waiting for him.
"The officers are in the old bear's tent again, talking something fierce."
"That's what they do," said Chet. "They're high-born, all but Blaine. They get drunk on words instead of wine."
Lark sidled closer.
"Cheese for wits. Keeps going on about the bird," he warned, glancing about to make certain no one was close. "Now he's asking if we cached any seed for the damn thing."
"It's a raven," said Chet. "It eats corpses." Lark grinned.
"Is, might be."
"Or yours."
It seemed to Chet that they needed the big man more than they needed Lark.
"Stop fretting about small Paul. You do your part, he'll do his."
Twilight was creeping through the woods by the time he rid himself of the sister man and sat down to edge his sword. It was bloody hard work, with his gloves on, but he wasn't about to take them off. Cold as it was, any fool that touched steel with a bare hand was going to lose a patch of skin. The dogs whimpered when the sun went down. He gave them water and curses.
"Half a night more, and you can find your own feast."
By then, he could smell supper. Dywin was holding forth at the cook fire as Chet got his heel of hard bread and a bowl of bean and bacon soup from Hake the cook.
"The wood's too silent," the old forester was saying. "No frogs near that river. No owls in the dark. I never heard no dead of wood in this." "Them teeth of yours sound pretty dead," said Hick. Darwin clacked his wooden teeth.
"No woods neither. There was before, but no more. Where'd they go, you figure?"
"Someplace warm," said Chet. Of the dozen odd brothers who sat by the fire, four were his. He gave each one a hard, squinty look as he ate, to see if any showed signs of breaking. Dirk seemed calm enough, sitting silent and sharpening his blade the way he did every night, and sweet Donald Hill was all easy japes. He had white teeth and fat red lips and yellow locks that he wore in an artful tumble about his shoulders, and he came to be the bastard of some Lannister. Well, maybe he was at that. Chet had no use for pretty boys, nor for bastards neither, but sweet Donald seemed like to hold his own. He was less certain about the forester the brothers called Saw Wood, more for his snoring than for anything to do with trees. Just now he looked so restless he might never snore again. And Maslin was worse. Chet could see sweat trickling down his face, despite the frigid wind. The beads of moisture sparkled in the firelight like so many little wet jewels. Maslin wasn't eating neither, only staring at his soup, as if the smell of it was about to make him sick.
"I'll need to watch that one," Chet thought.
"Assemble!" The shout came suddenly from a dozen throats and quickly spread to every part of the hilltop camp. "Men of the Night's Watch, assemble at the central fire!" Frowning, Chet finished his soup and followed the rest. The old bear stood before the fire with Smallwood, Luck, Withers and Blaine ranged behind him in a row. Mormont wore a cloak of thick black fur, and his raven perched upon his shoulder, preening its black feathers.
"This can't be good."
Chet squeezed between Brown Banar and some Shadow Tower men. When everyone was gathered, save for the watchers in the woods and the guards on the ring wall, Mormont cleared his throat and spat. The spittle was frozen before it hit the ground.
"Brothers," he said, "men of the Night's Watch."
"Men,"
his raven screamed.
"Men, men."
"The wildlings are on the march, following the course of the Milkwater down out of the mountains. Thorin believes their van will be upon us 10 days hence. Their most seasoned raiders will be with Harmer Dogshead in that van. The rest will likely form a rear guard, or ride in close company with Mance Raider himself. Elsewhere, their fighters will be spread thin along the line of march. They have oxen, mules, horses, but few enough. Most will be afoot, and ill-armed and untrained. Such weapons as they carry are more like to be stone and bone than steel. They're burdened with women, children, herds of sheep and goats, and all their worldly goods besides. In short, though they are numerous, they are vulnerable. And they do not know that we are here. Also, we must pray."
"They know," thought Chet. "You bloody old pusbag, they know. Certain as sunrise. Corin Halfhand hasn't come back, has he? Nor Jarmin Butwell. If any of them got caught, you know damn well the wildlings will have wrung a song or two out of them by now."
Smallwood stepped forward. "Mance Raider means to break the wall and bring red war to the Seven Kingdoms. Well, that's a game two can play. On the morrow, we'll bring the war to him."
"We ride at dawn with all our strength," the old bear said, as a murmur went through the assembly. "We will ride north and loop around to the west. Harmer's van will be well past the fist by the time we turn. The foothills of the Frostfangs are full of narrow, winding valleys made for ambush. Their line of march will stretch for many miles. We shall fall on them in several places at once and make them swear we were 3,000, not 300.
"We'll hit hard and be away before the horsemen can form up to face us," Thorin Smallwood said. "If they pursue, we'll lead them a merry chase, then wheel and hit again further down the column. will burn their wagons, scatter their herds, and slay as many as we can. Mance Rede himself, if we find him. If they break and return to their hovels, we've won. If not, we'll harrow them all the way to the wall and see to it that they leave a trail of corpses to mark their progress.
There are thousands, someone called from behind Chet.
We'll die!
That was Maslin's voice, green with fear.
Die!
Screamed Mormont's raven, flapping its black wings.
Die! Die! Die!
Many of us, the old bear said. Mayhaps even all of us. But as another Lord Commander said, 1,000 years ago, that is why they dress us in black. Remember your words, brothers, for we are the swords in the darkness, the watchers on the walls.
The fire that burns against the cold,
Sir Maldor Locke drew his longsword.
The light that brings the dawn,
others answered, and more swords were pulled from scabbards. Then all of them were drawing, and it was near 300 upraised swords and as many voices crying, "The horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men!" Chet had no choice but to join his voice to the others. The air was misty with their breath, and firelight glinted off the steel. He was pleased to see Lark and Softfoot and sweet Donal Hill joining in, as if they were as big fools as the rest. That was good. No sense to draw attention when their hour was so close. When the shouting died away, once more he heard the sound of the wind picking at the ring wall. The flames swirled and shivered, as if they too were cold, and in the sudden quiet the old bear's raven cawed loudly and once again said,
"Die!"
Clever bird, thought Chet, as the officers dismissed them, warning everyone to get a good meal and a long rest tonight. Chet crawled under his furs near the dogs, his head full of things that could go wrong. What if that bloody oath gave one of his a change of heart? Or Small Paul forgot and tried to kill Mormont during the second watch in place of the third? Or Maslin lost his courage, or some untamed informer, or... He found himself listening to the night. The wind did sound like a wailing child, and from time to time he could hear men's voices, a horse's whinny, a log spitting in the fire, but nothing else.
So quiet.
He could see Bessa's face floating before him.
"It wasn't a knife I wanted to put in you,"
he wanted to tell her.
"I picked you flowers, wild roses and tansy and golden cups. It took me all morning."
His heart was thumping like a drum, so loud he feared it might wake the camp. Ice caked his beard all round his mouth.
"Where did that come from, with Bessa?"
Whenever he'd thought of her before, it had only been to remember the way she looked, dying. What was wrong with him? He could hardly breathe. Had he gone to sleep? He got to his knees, and something wet and cold touched his nose. Chet looked up. Snow was falling. He could feel tears freezing to his cheeks.
"It isn't fair," he wanted to scream.
Snow would ruin everything he'd worked for, all his careful plans. It was a heavy fall, thick white flakes coming down all about him. How would they find their food caches in the snow, or the game trail they meant to follow east?
"They won't need Darwin nor Bannon to hunt us down neither. Not if we're tracking through fresh snow."
And snow hid the shape of the ground, especially by night. A horse could stumble over a root, break a leg on a stone.
"We're done,"
he realized.
"Done before we began. We're lost."
There'd be no lord's life for the leechman's son. No keep to call his own, no wives, nor crowns. Only a wildling sword in his belly, and then an unmarked grave.
"The snow's taken it all from me. A bloody snow."
Snow had ruined him once before. Snow and his pet pig. Chet got to his feet. His legs were stiff, and the falling snowflakes turned the distant torches to vague orange glows. He felt as though he were being attacked by a cloud of pale, cold bugs. They settled on his shoulders, on his head. They flew at his nose and his eyes.